Welcome to Lyme Time. I'm Allie from the Tick Chicks. We are all more than Lyme disease and chronic illness, and together we stand with you to overcome and rise. I'll bring you closer to the experts in cutting-edge treatments and even a few unexpected ways of healing. I'll ask the questions you want answers to regarding Lyme disease and successful ways of getting you closer to 100%. We are in this together and will not be defined by Lyme. Today on Lyme Time, I am so thrilled to introduce you to Dr. Omar Morales. I'm going to read a little bit about him first because he's worth bragging about. So I will embarrass him for a second and then I'll introduce him and we'll just have a great chat here. Dr. Morales is a distinguished medical professional with a profound impact on the field of transfusion medicine, particularly in the context of immunological diseases. Born in the U.S. and raised in Mexico, his journey into the medical world was unconventional, shaped by the intervention of his father, who redirected him from a life in construction to one dedicated to healing. Dr. Morales' academic journey took him to the University of Guadalajara, where he earned a secondary degree in transfusion medicine. Currently residing in Puerto Vallarta, Dr. Morales is the visionary behind the Lyme Mexico Clinic. His commitment to advancing healthcare extends beyond the clinic, as he serves as the chair of the ILADS Latin America Workgroup and is a former member of the ILADS Board of Directors and current chair of ILADS Public Relations Committee. Additionally, he plays a crucial role in the advisory board of California Spinal Rehab Clinic and oversees the Puerto Vallarta Blood Bank, demonstrating a multifaceted dedication to the well-being of his community. The journey into Lyme disease treatment began for Dr. Morales through a serendipitous encounter with a patient a decade ago. Introduced by his father, the patient exhibited a complex case involving pathogens like Anaplasma, Bartonella, and Babesia that had confounded 30 different physicians in their hometown. Driven by frustration and determination, the patient sought help at Dr. Morales' clinic in Puerto Vallarta. Collaborating with an ILADS member and mentor, Dr. Morales crafted a comprehensive treatment plan involving plasmapheresis, a red cell exchange, antibiotics, and antiparasitics. The success of this intervention marked a turning point, inspiring Dr. Morales to delve deeper into tick-borne diseases. This profound experience not only solidified his commitment to Lyme disease treatments, but also created enduring connections with the patient and their family. Dr. Morales' dedication to advancing medical knowledge has been instrumental in transforming babesiosis treatment through red cell exchanges. Leveraging his background in transfusion medicine, he has pioneered novel approaches to address complex blood pathogens. His contributions extend beyond clinical practice as he actively engages in research at the Biomedical Center in Mexico, contributing to both international and national scientific work. A firm believer in the power of multidisciplinary and integrative approaches, Dr. Morales envisions a future where effective medical research will redefine the understanding and treatment of Lyme disease within the broader healthcare community. His personal experiences and relentless dedication underscore his commitment to providing the best possible care, ensuring that every patient receives the support needed to overcome health challenges. Dr. Morales stands as a beacon of hope for those navigating the intricate landscape of Lyme disease, embodying the spirit of resilience and innovation in the face of adversity. Welcome, Dr. Morales.
Wow, that Dr. Morales sure sounds like a great guy.
Well, he is. And we're very honored to have you here on Lyme Time speaking with us about a lot of different things. But I think most people will be curious about the red cell exchange treatment program. So just kind of backtracking a little bit, and I know your father had a huge impact in your path and your journey here. Before receiving this patient into your clinic, what was your understanding? I know that you were a member of ILADS and you had some understanding of Lyme disease, but tell me.
I actually wasn't, and thank you, Ali, for this invitation.
Sure. Okay, so
The
you had the patient first, and then that's what segued you
didn't
into Lyme.
online. I didn't know anything about Babesia or any. I mean, I just knew about pathogens in the blood to a certain degree. And when I hear that we're having a patient coming over because the patient is having organ failure, the kidneys are shutting down. And at that point, I'm working in the blood bank. And I have to say that in the blood bank, as you know, there are always transfusion-related risks. If you go and donate blood, maybe you know or do not know that you have some pathogens, which are going to be then transferred to someone else who's receiving your blood. And that's how it's been since blood banking was invented. And it's slowly have been improving the methodology on how things occur so that everything is safer. And back then, which is about 10 years ago, a little bit more, we already had a lot of protocols in place to inactivate pathogens. And as you see in as you saw on my bio there, my father was a very important part of my development as a doctor, as a man as well, obviously, but as a doctor, he gave me a lot of just courage to do things, and he was, to be honest, ahead of his time. He was a very brilliant man, and he but I'm gonna say that in the early 2000s, he developed this equipment which was using ultraviolet light, and that would activate that would inactivate pathogens, and he would use it for his patients. He was one of the top hematologists in my country, in Mexico, and so he would use the UV light to inactivate cancer activity and to inactivate pathogens and for a number of purposes. The first iteration of that device, I remember that we actually built it ourselves from literally a metal box. I think it was used originally to like put bread in there, and we would make the perfect box, which we then just in the inside made it all made out of mirrors, and the UV lights would go on top. And this is something that nobody was doing back then, and we were basically cleaning blood before we even knew about these pathogens. And many years later, I remember my dad meeting with some of the people that were providing the apheresis machines to us, and my dad was telling them, "Oh, you should add UV light because it's gonna make the perfect machine." And I remembered, like 15 years later, they started adding those UV light machines to their apheresis, and they were, of course, selling them for hundreds of thousands of dollars. But the point is that we were kind of prepared already to treat infections without knowing what was ahead of us. So my dad, he was the owner of the blood bank then, and I was his right hand, and I was working there, and someone called for this infected patient, which was having kidney problems, shutting down the kidneys, and so they put me in charge of this, and they flew in with their doctor, who's an islets doctor, and this is the first time I hear about islets. And this guy, of course, we became close friends. He became a mentor for me, and he taught me all these things that I didn't know back then. So once that patient was treated, and I may say successfully, because he was about to die, he hadn't really had a conversation with his father because he couldn't even speak at that point. And so by the time we were kind of halfway, three quarters into the treatment, this kid, he would be able to sit up in the hospital bed, and he talked to his father, and he told his father, "I love you. Thank you for bringing me here. Thank you for helping me. Thank you for not giving up on me." And I'll never remember, I'll never forget that his father, who was a very well-educated man, very like very formal guy, he shed a tear, and he said, "Do you know what my son just told me?" And I was like, Wow, like how are we doing this? Like I didn't even know this existed, and now we're curing people, or not curing, but we're getting them better. So I was so involved. I was so just attached to it. And so when that finished, they said to me, if you want to go to ILATS, we will sponsor you to go to ILATS.
Yeah.
And that was my first step into that realm. And then I got into ILATS the first time, and I was there, and I was just seeing all these doctors who I would literally admire, like gods almost, because I would read their books and would see what they were doing on stage. And I was like, wow. And I would get there and make a line and talk to them and have them sign my book. And like, it was just fantastic for me. It was a whole new world. And I came back to Mexico, and I felt like I knew something that the rest of the Mexican community didn't. And so I feel very special, definitely. That's how my path got started many years ago.
It's very interesting that an ILADS doctor flew with his patient to you in Mexico to try something, because in the United States, then it was probably experimental, and it was obviously experimental in Mexico. But it's interesting to me that they had to go to such extreme measures to actually try something new.
So that's been something that's been always the Achilles heel of Americans and Canadians as well, that certain techniques which are known to be useful in medicine will not be available to everybody unless you have a terminal illness, or you're lacking a spleen, or you have HIV, and then you're a candidate. So only when you're on your deathbed you become a candidate. So in those circumstances, Mexico has, I believe, always been a lending hand to that function, and I guess that's why there's also always that American-Mexican collaboration of science, where we're always testing out stuff, before it becomes available in the U.S. I don't know if you've ever heard that before, but I come from a tough town of Tijuana. I grew up in Tijuana, and I got to see some of the best medicine and medical tourism ever that I've seen anywhere else in the world ahead of its time. And the reason being that it's so close to the border that all of these doctors and scientists from one part of the world get to meet with these other doctors and scientists who also know something, and it's like both areas know something and they both ignore something, and when they get together something cool happens. So it was a way I was brought up. When I was young, my dad would have those kind of interactions, and he literally passed that on to me, and I met these doctors, this fantastic ILADS doctor then, and he introduced me to these techniques, and we were able to do them, and we are doing them now, now more, I would say, much more thorough and with different components. But back then, it was a first for us for sure. Nowadays, from what my supplier says, we are the number one purchaser of those equipments in whole Latin America. And so
Wow.
that says that probably we may even be the one biggest in all of America. So I believe we've come a long way from that one starting point, and successfully so far.
I'm guessing it's because of the regulations in the United States that we have, that we just, it takes us many, many years to accomplish going through all the checks and balances. Or something must be holding us up in that regard. Would you say that? Because I know they can also do certain things in Germany, and they have certain lab allowances in Greece, even in Switzerland, treatments. But in the United States, everybody's searching for people to do this, and quite honestly, they're still going to Mexico.
Yeah, and there was a point where I actually opened an office in New York, and it didn't work because we couldn't do much of what we wanted to do to be useful, because we my goal in this is to make a change, and to get patients to not only feel better but stay better. And I've seen over the years that it is complex to get them better and to have them remain in remission or being better. And that sometimes for that you will need many resources. And to have all those resources under one roof, you would need so many requirements, legally speaking, that it's, I don't think it would be feasible. I think it would be drown the doctor would first drown in so much paperwork in order to have all of these things under one roof. And I understand it's the system in America. It's a different system here. I don't think that our one system is better than the other, and or for that purpose, Germany or Switzerland or any other. I think they all have something that is interesting, and that's why getting the best out of both worlds is what I believe is best as well. And usually I do get them to do the best out of both worlds. I get them to do certain treatments here, and then I get them to use pharmaceuticals that are from the United States, which I believe they have the best quality, and the supplements they have the best quality. So there's always going to be that kind of interaction back and forth.
That's wonderful. And I guess before we get into certain specifics of treatments, I want to just make it clear that obviously you don't accept American health care insurance or anything like that. So anybody traveling to Mexico would then come out of pocket.
So some cases they have been able to get their expenses covered by their insurance. They pay it out of pocket, and then their insurance, their private insurance, then they reimburse them. There is a company that we've worked with. They're called Medical Bill Gurus, and they've been able to acquire some of those expenses back from them. And then we've been able to work well with them, and they collect a, some kind of percentage from what they're getting back for their patients, but I think it's worth it.
Can you tell me the name of that again?
Medical Bill Gurus.
Medical bill gurus for everybody out there listening. Okay.
And we've worked with them with several, and I've actually seen people getting reimbursed. So like that's, yeah,
That's
feasible.
wonderful. So let's dive into
Also, in that regard, some people come with the fear of what if they need hospitalization for some reason, and you can also purchase a simple travel insurance. And I've had in some cases, like I'll give you an example. Like I had a patient who had PANDAS. He was an adult, and he had his travel insurance with him. And when he was here, he was able to get his tonsils out during that traveling, and it was covered. So that was fantastic.
that's amazing. Okay, so everybody out there are ways that you can investigate to go make your insurance work for you, or make certain companies that will work on your behalf available to you. So we're here with Dr. Morales on line time, and he's going to talk now, I hope, a little bit about red cell exchange therapy. And in the United States, do they call it something else, or is it universally known as red cell exchange?
It's universally known as red cell exchanges, and it's a treatment that is not your first choice of treatment. Your first choice of treatment should always be the antimalarials, and that's how it's stated because it produces the less level of side effects, and there is enough evidence that shows that there can be improvements. Now, in patients who don't improve after doing that treatment, and they still have babesia, then they can seek a secondary or third option. And that's where red cell exchange comes into play. Babesia, when, as I said, in certain cases, like patients without a spleen or patients with HIV, they would also qualify as, I believe, a first and second line of therapy. And for, as far as red cell exchanges, and it's not regular, it's not a regular treatment that is offered, but it is something that can be done as a first or second line of treatment in those scenarios.
Okay, and Just to clarify, is it primarily then for Babesia?
So, because Babesia as a parasite lives solely in the red blood cell, then as a result, the parasitemia or the level of parasites will decrease if you get someone's infected blood and exchange it for healthy blood. We're only exchanging the red blood cells, nothing else. We're not exchanging plasma or platelets or white blood cells or DNA, none at all. It's only the red blood cell, which is composed of iron and proteins that are going to be carrying oxygen. So that's the only purpose, and that should not put anybody in any kind of fear, as long as the blood is risk-free, of course. And so, as a blood bank that we are, we make sure that we screen all of our donors. We try to get them from the university. We try to get them from the soccer fields. We try to get the younger individuals. We also have a data bank where we know who is blood type and when and their age and their background. And so we go through that screening process. Then we test them from A to C of everything that has to happen, like any international standard for blood banking. And then that blood now goes after then after that that goes through the pathogen inactivation protocol that I was mentioning. So when my dad was in charge of the blood bank, he was using UV-light. And when I got to be in charge of the blood bank, I implemented a photosensitizing agent. After visiting Australia, I learned it there that by using photosensitizing agents in blood components, the UV light that we're using produces a full effect, inhibiting up to 99.9 pathogens of different sources. There are studies that talk about HIV, hepatitis, Chagas. 99.9 pathogen removal. And so that's why it's such a practical treatment. And so we do that to the blood. So by the end, that blood is purified. We then sometimes also add ozone to that blood, and then we have that blood ready for the patient. Then the patient is connected to the machine, and then the blood starts flowing out. And then once it floats out, then this new blood comes in. And so it's a dilution process. It doesn't happen all at once. You are talking about someone has like 5 liters worth of blood in total in the body, and every red cell exchange would be like 25% of blood of the whole body.
Okay, I have so many questions. So first of all, are you're using somebody else's blood or
So
you're using your own blood?
you can do it in many ways, but the way that is the most effective is in a patient that is highly infected with Babesia, getting rid of his blood and replacing it for someone healthy.
I see.
And it's better when it's healthy and young because it carries more oxygen. So the patient's result is it immediately bounces back.
Oh,
You can
amazing.
also take that blood from that patient and then treat it and then return it. That's more or less medium to moderate effect.
Okay, so whose decision is that then? Is it up to the physician to say, really, you need somebody else's blood, or yours is okay enough that we can use yours?
So theoretically speaking, first the patient receives the antimalarials. The patient does not improve after doing the combinations and is getting worse. That's one scenario. Or the patient is having organ failure, the patient is his life is in risk, in danger, then also those two are candidates for doing red cell exchange. So it's not just for everybody. One has to be a candidate.
I see. So then
So
it's
once
obviously up to the physician because they can't talk for themselves.
at that point is the physician trying to save the patient's life. So if the physician in this case, myself, would say, well, I'm going to give you the best recommendation, which is remove your infected blood. And so the machine is able to select the most condensed cells and the thickest cells in that blood of that patient. So the first cells that come out are the ones that potentially have the bigger number of pathogens. Because pathogens are very they interact with this with the red cell surface with the erythrocyte. As a result, the erythrocyte becomes sticky because it loses its properties. So it becomes big and sticky. So it clumps up, and that's why the Babesia patients often have too many circulation problems because the blood is clumping up and delivering less oxygen. And so those are the cells that come out that are coming out initially. And as those are coming out, we're replacing them for someone healthy's blood. Now, I will say that I have had patients who have flown in their own candidates, and I think that that's great because they want, like, maybe they're a certain religion and they want to have their own individuals do the blood donor, be the blood donors for them, or their family, or their friends, or someone they have known for years. And that has also a good effect also on whoever's helping out. They feel like they're contributing to their health.
Yeah, I'm sure they trust that side of the process that they could bring to the table. And I could see that. How is this different than from a blood transfusion?
So a blood transfusion, when you donate blood, it comes out 70% plasma or 60% plasma, and about 10% platelets and white blood cells, and then the rest is compact red blood cells. So you're taking out a whole lot of things, and so then you separate those things and you give platelets to someone who's bleeding or having bleeding disorders. You give plasma to someone who has immunological disorders, and you have the red blood cells, which will be specifically for patients who have either bleeding disorders where they're having ongoing bleeding, hemorrhaging, or in other cases like this where they require to replace their blood. And so that would be the transfusion. But in the way we do it, we're not doing it in that same method. We're doing a selective cellular separation. So we're separating only red blood cells. We're not taking plasma, we're not taking platelets, we're not taking any immunological cell. We're only selecting the most dense red blood cells to take out. And we are selecting the same high quality red blood cells from the donor as well. So it's considered more than twice as much the volume of red blood cells when we do it this way versus a regular donation.
So if you're cleaning out about 99.9% of pathogens in this process, why
And
is
did you say that? Just to clarify, this
Yes.
is with the pathogen inactivation process that is done with UV light and photosensitizing agents. But I think I know where you're going. Could we do that with our patients? And if so, why don't we just do that instead of replacing their blood? If that's the question, and if it's not, let me just answer, go ahead and answer that.
Sure.
Because the die-off would be tremendous. That's sometimes the problem. And so this is interesting that sometimes, like patients with Bartonella, a lot of the red blood cells have Bartonella and anaplasma as well. So as you're taking out those infected cells, you're not just treating Babesia, you're also treating anaplasma and you're also treating Bartonella as a consequence of, not directly.
Right.
And if you were to treat that patient who is bedbound and super sick and has a terrible homeostasis or no good, zero positive environment in their blood, if you start giving that patient intense treatment, the hurting of that patient is so tremendous that the patient wants to stop treatment. The patient will want to, immediately get hospitalized because he will feel terrible. So as a result, how do we treat them? We first remove the infection and then we give them the treatment. That way, the patient has much better tolerance to treatment. And so, in cases where they haven't been able to treat because of that circumstance, that they go to their doctor and just every treatment makes them feel horrible, then those patients we do red blood cell exchange. And then after that, we treat them. And now they tolerate treatment.
Yeah, that was basically my question. It's sort of like if this is doing wonderful things for people, why would we wait until they were on their deathbed, so to speak, to is there a way that you see in the future that this will become a reality where the normal person could go in for these type of treatments and not have it be such a big hurting experience that they would want to stop it?
When I started doing the red blood cell exchange treatments, it was to, in a very basic way, revolutionary because it wasn't being done at that level. I think that the future holds other technology that could be applied to inactivate pathogens without having to use someone else's blood. I think ultimately that would be the best way, because then that way we don't have to worry about any consequences of using red blood cells from someone else. There are other things to be concerned about when we're using blood. It's not a walk in the park by no means. Done right and selecting the candidates and monitoring everything, we've done great, and nobody has had any kind of casualty or disability from it. On the contrary, they have improved and gotten in remission. Babesia has been cured, and that's great. But there are other things that we need to obviously consider when we're using blood. So blood is not something that should be done lightly. And so, as a to answer your question, I think that there should be more. There will be other technologies that will probably be available in the future that should be better than just doing the red cell exchanges. But for now, for patients on those circumstances, that is the best resource in the deathbed scenario.
Wow, it just seems that with such a good result that it's a shame that it isn't somehow available to, because I bet a lot of people listening to this right now feel like they're on their deathbed, and certainly people that follow me are sometimes children are hospitalized, they can't tolerate anything, not even water sometimes. And it's very, very, very traumatic and sad. So I'm glad that we're at least in empowering people to understand that if it gets to that point, that this would be an option. But it
Don't
feels
get me
like
wrong.
there's a lot between the beginning stages of Lyme and that end result.
I do want to clarify, I do see patients where they're not in their deathbed and we're doing these treatments because they've tried already good treatments and they haven't been able to get better. And so those patients would be candidates as well. But I tend to look at everything going on, and I try not to focus on one place, on one condition. I never get married to one disease because we have so many things that we have to also do detective work and address. And there can be environmental problems, there can be mold exposure, mast cell activity, problems that are structural problems from encephalitis or from PANDAS or from PANS. I've been seeing more and more inflammatory demyelinating neuropathies. I've been seeing patients with problems in their gums and in their jaw where they have had root canals. And as a result, infection gets encapsulated between the root canal and the jawbone, causing cavitations. Then these cavitations causes osteomyelitis, which infects the bone. And then that produces neuropathy that goes to the spine and to the brain and to the nerves and the peripheral nerves. And so when I hear of a patient who's having symptoms that don't make sense after the treatments that they've done, I'm gonna do my detective work and determine what's the cause and not necessarily just offer red cell exchange indiscriminately. So they have to speak to a doctor, and the doctor has to help them assess this. Unfortunately, for some of our patients, they have to play the role of their own doctor because sometimes they will feel that that's the best course because doctors sometimes will not hear them. I think that is changing. I think the CDC is more acceptant of the situation now. I think they have even accepted that this is a chronic condition. And I'm talking about Lyme. Of course, Lyme is the umbrella for all these other co-infections. And those things are helping us. Now, more and more, we're seeing doctors saying, Hey, I think this is a patient you should see. Like now they're referring us when back in the day they were literally being afraid of what we were doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to talk about exactly what you do offer to sort of the quote unquote everyday patient of Lyme disease, people who have, in their opinions, tried everything. They've ruled out lots of different things, and they're still eating. They're eating correctly. They're not in a moldy environment. They're doing cleaning their diet. They've done the round of antibiotics or two or three, and they're still not finding any relief. So let's say they come across Lyme Disease Mexico, which is yours, and tell me how their journey there would be different, and what who your typical patient would be from the United States, let's just say.
So I see patients from all over, from Poland, from Italy, Spain, Australia, New Zealand, the US, Canada, of course, Mexico. And the I have these set of questions I ask my patients in a very systematic manner, because that's the system that I made one day to understand what's going on, and it works well because it gives me an image of what could be wrong that hasn't been addressed besides the typical Lyme condition. And there, for years, I've done this, and I learned through you guys as well. And us as doctors, we learn through you guys. So I want to hear you. I want to see what's going on so that I can also broaden my understanding of things. And so as a result, I always offer my first consult free of charge, and I've been doing that for 10 years. That way, I think it's fair because I get to be able to ask whatever I need to understand what's going on, and in a very unbiased method, provide a suggestion. And some patients t call me and tell me, I don't want to come and see you. I just want some information, and I just want your opinion, and I will give them my honest opinion. So I like what I do, and for that reason I'm able to do it the way I like it. And then some people will tell me, hey, you're the one I'm looking for, and I want to see you, and they come down here. So that's great. It works out for everybody. So I always will evaluate those patients individually because they're all different. And if a patient has done what I feel is a good treatment, because I've had patients who have done good treatments in other places or have tried good treatments with other doctors, and I will be surprised to hear that they're still sick. And so I will say, this doesn't make sense to me. And they will tell them that this, you have done good treatment, you have addressed everything that I would normally address, and you're still sick. So let's put all of this that we're talking about on the side. What else is going on? Have you had surgeries? How do you have dental problems? Have you had environmental exposures? Do you have had did you ever hit yourself in the head? Were you born to term or not? Do you have any methylation problem, any genetic deficiency? So I analyze everything until I get something. And there's always something. I to this date, I haven't been able to not diagnose a patient. To this day, I've been able to do that. It may take me a while, but and it's quite honestly detective work. But at the end, both of us, patient and doctor, we feel that we are on the right track, and that the only way to get there is by asking questions.
It's first of all, how refreshing to have a doctor say that the first initial consult is free. That's unheard of. So that's just such a welcoming, wonderful example of the kind of physician that you are, and specializing in immunology. And it also speaks to the truth about Lyme disease. As one of my doctors put it, you have Lyme disease. It probably isn't the first thing that you ever got in your journey, and it might not be the last thing ever. So So it, to me, that kind of put it into perspective and made sense that the things that I had prior to Lyme disease kind of gave me the perfect environment for Lyme disease to rear its ugly head. And then after that, I have definitely, I have a weakened immune system now because of all the things layering up. And so it's nice to have it all addressed in one place. Tell me, what other treatments do you offer besides the red cell therapy?
So when I started with this whole path of tick-borne disorders, let me know if you don't hear me well. I think you hear me well, right? The treatment was apheresis only when I started. All right. Then as I started visiting Germany, Australia, the United States, Washington, Texas, Utah, my brain opened up to other treatments and treatment options and treatment modalities. So from starting with just apheresis, it became something very large of so many treatments that I was applying for a patient. And I got to the place where I said, this is too much treatment, so I'm gonna start choosing these things. And I started picking and choosing what I thought. Just honestly, I started just doing that based on what I was reading, like articles and the conferences and the one-on-ones, talks on with other physicians. So things that would make more sense. So at the end of the day, I ended up having all these tools in one toolbox from starting with two tools. But nowadays, instead of doing treatments like this, I'm doing them like this, selecting each treatment for each patient, and doing so. Keeping in mind, I always kind of like to imagine how bacteria would behave. So I imagine like a boat sinking, and the boat has like several holes. Let's say it has eight holes. And you're gonna go and you're gonna plug one hole with your finger, and you're maybe attending to active infection. And then you try and plug another thing, and maybe you're detoxifying the patient. And then you may want to put your feet on another hole, and you're gonna attack biofilm. And then you do another, and then you're attacking the immune response. And so that's how I look at these conditions. And I'm quite OCD myself, so I never allow myself to leave things out of the equation when it comes to treatment, so that we can address everything. And sometimes that can become annoying to patients because, but why are we doing this? And I'll explain then why am I doing that. But the reality is that that gives me much better results than just putting my finger on and plugging one hole. And because this infection has many resources at its disposal to try and evade us, and to try and persist, and to try and just flee from our hands. So as a result, many treatments. I can talk to you about the ones that are my favorite, but I want to say that treatments don't create results. The understanding of the condition creates the result. And so we have to understand that at least four things are necessary to address, particularly, I'm going to say, in tick-borne diseases in general. We have to address the active infection first. That's the easy part. You can kill active infection with virtually antibiotics, herbs, tinctures. If you're doing that in a non dis if you're just using it nonstop, you're going to basically provide the bacteria with the need to create the number two problem, which is biofilm and persisting forms. Lyme in particular is pleomorphic, is a shapeshifter. It'll have blebs, cysts, yarn ball looking communities, and biofilms, which will hide from your immune system and will hide from the treatments. So you can be receiving treatment, intense treatment, but if you're not doing it with a sense of understanding of why you need to put your feet on the gas and then when to put your feet on the brakes, then the infection just makes biofilm. And that's what a lot of the time happens, because unfortunately there is no right there hasn't been someone that has came out and said, this is the undeniable course of treatment that you have to do with everybody, right? Everybody has their own ideas. And so what I've taken from all of the ideas that I've experienced and what I have seen and observed is killing active infection, eradicating biofilm, helping the immune system is number three. And so the immune system will be affected because Lyme produces a protein that inhibits the maturity of many immunological cells. As a result, a lot of immune cells that would be normally a grown police for the immune system is a baby police for the immune system. So it's not going to be capable of detecting what needs to be targeted. So it'll create a baby-like response, a mess. It's going to make a mess in the immune system. That's where you see cytokine storms, mast cell activity, encephalitis, all of those things happen because the immune system is immature and is naive, or in other words, is corrupt. Okay. So we have to re-educate the immune system. I'll talk about each of those, how we do it, but those are the three points. And then the fourth, detox. This is key because there is no book of medicine that tells you, oh, yes, in chapter seven of the Harrison Book of Internal Medicine, you have to give your patient detox. It doesn't exist. That's like witchcraft. And I learned once I had my share of tick-borne issues myself, and once I went to a small town up in the mountains, like 6 hours away from here. I drove there, and they have this spot where they focused on detox, and I heard it would do wonders. And I went there and I felt amazing afterwards, after being there, after following their diet, after following their detox, after doing so many coffee enemas that I was going crazy and all of these things. I would be bathed in clay all around and eating only vegetables. So I understood what I had to do. I had to implement these things in my current medical practice, and I did. And then I added other things that I learned and Germany, where they're doing binders, intravenous binders, chelation, things to make patients eliminate toxins. Patients have to poop. If they don't poop, the toxins are inside. If they don't sweat, the toxins are inside. So we started doing protocols that were focused on artificially getting all their toxins out. And that is the key. It's like, how do you get from your home to the hospital if the whole street is filled with snow because it snowed the whole day? How do you get there? You have to blow out the snow. So the same thing for treating you. If you want to get to the infection, you have to clear the path. And clearing the path means plowing out all those toxins. Those
And
are the
so
four things.
I love that. I love it because I definitely believe in those four things. And you have to take them in order too, don't you? And you have to understand what your body is doing. So tell me, you said you were going to name your favorite treatments, but we're all giving you the caveat that we know that this is not for everyone, but what are your four favorites?
Okay, I'm gonna name one for each, okay?
Okay.
For killing active infections, I like a combination of intravenous. Oh, I rarely do oral recommendations. I believe oral treatments have a function, and it's more for the aftercare.
Yeah.
Not for moving the needle,
Not for
okay?
acute, like the acute phase, but more for maintenance.
Exactly. So a combination of intravenous antimicrobials, at least one that is for intracellular infection, one that is for extracellular infection, and one that is for cyst or persisting forms or round body infection. That is number one. Okay. I like to combine that with oxidative therapies, hyperbaric ozone, silver. I love silver, by the way. I've been using silver since before I even since I was in finishing medical school. I graduated with honors of all things. I wasn't the most brilliant student, but I did a thesis on silver nanoparticles helped by a research team of the Center of Nanoscience and Nanotechnology, which now I'm part of. And I gave silver to certain for certain conditions, and we found that silver has a lot of activity. So now we're doing specific silver for specific conditions, but that's another story. The point is that silver intravenously prolongs the half-life of the antibiotics, improves the effects of antigen-presenting cells in the immune system. So there are many functions that silver does. So oxidative therapies with a combination of intravenous antimicrobials. Number two, for persisting forms, I use a cocktail of that we have for biofilm treatment, which is it this cocktail is used in combination with hyperthermia. Now, hyperthermia, you'll hear people that say that it's amazing and that they've been cured from just doing hyperthermia alone. I think that those circumstances can happen. I don't think that that's the case for all patients. I've heard doctors say, "Oh, I can cure you with hyperthermia," and I can, and I heard another say, "And I can cure you with ozone." And I was like, "I'm going out of this lecture because this doesn't make sense." There is no truth that will stand for everybody because everybody is different. There are five different types of Borrelias. There are over 300 different strains worldwide. How can we expect to have the same result when someone may have 2 or 10 or 20 different strains? How can we? So then that versus the genetics of that patient. So we have to always plan for the worst. And we'll be prepared for the worst, but try to get the best outcome. So hyperthermia, the one thing that is unquestionable of hyperthermia is that it increases the temperature, allowing the tissues that normally have very little to no blood flow to actually have blood flow. Tendons, joints, nerves, pathways that lead to the brain. And when you have increased blood flow and you inject a patient with antimicrobials or antibiotics, what do you get? You get perfusion and penetration. So as a result, we are able to destroy biofilms in the smallest places where usually antibiotics don't get in there. That is what I like about that number two. So eradicating biofilm, if you don't eradicate biofilm, this infection is a vicious cycle. So again, number one, killing active infection, antimicrobials, oxidative therapies. Number two, hyperthermia and the antimicrobials that I use specifically for biofilm, which by the way have been published and have shown to eradicate biofilm by that cocktail alone. But when we put it with the hyperthermia, we're much more successful. Number three, immunological re-education. Remember when I said Lyme suppresses the maturation of cells. So we have a cell separator, which we use to separate blood, we use to separate plasma, and we use to separate mononuclear cells, immune cells of one nucleus. We have in the mononuclear cells dendritic cells. Dendritic cells are, by definition, the best antigen-presenting cells of your whole immune system. That means that they capture a pathogen and they deliver it to the cells that they need to for its destruction and for those cells to engulf that pathogen and create pattern recognizing receptors. So a ripple effect, immunologically speaking, to re-educate the immune response. And we select those cells from the patient, which are immature dendritic cells. We provide growth factors in vitro to make them mature. We add our little secret recipe there, which I learned from my father, and to produce hyperactivity of that dendritic cell and maturation. And that way, those dendritic cells in 48 hours, they become aware of pathogens, they become mature, and they become active. We re-inject them back to the patient, and the patient has an immediate immunological re-education. And
Wow.
we made a vaccine out of that that is gonna last 8 weeks. So we freeze that product and we provide it to the patient frozen, and the patient goes back home with eight little vaccines frozen that they will unfreeze and inject subcutaneously in their abdomen. We teach them how. It's no big deal. There's virtually no side effects because it's their own product. They have been re-educated, and that is a effect that is very useful because of something very specific. Lyme suppresses the immune system. So once the Lyme is under control and you send that patient home, if the Lyme grows back, they're defenseless. And the immune system takes 3 months to regrow. And in those 3 months, Lyme can grow quicker than the immune system. So if we give them these dendritic cells, we basically make sure that the immune system has enough resources to keep the put a lid on Lyme so it doesn't grow quickly in those 3 months. And then after those 3 months, then patients have their immune system intact, no longer corrupt because the Lyme is no longer active or not as active. So that is important for the path to remission, the immune system. That's three. And fourth, detox. I like to use homotoxicology and plasmapheresis. Plasmapheresis is the best because plasmapheresis cleans your blood. Remember I said blood divides in liquid where 70% is plasma, where plasma has all the liquid toxins, all the exposures to environment that haven't been able to be removed by your body, even pharmaceuticals that you've taken, the delivery mechanisms are floating in your blood for 10 years. There's studies that talk about this. And mold, mycotoxins are floating in your blood in the plasma. So all of these things, all this gunk is in the plasma. So we take that and we take it out and we replace it, not for someone else's plasma. So this is why this treatment is for everybody. This is changing the oil in the engine type. This is change for proteins, like albumin, vitamins, amino acids, and electrolytes. And that creates a almost immediate result on the patient, helping him with less toxin burden.
Is that also, that's an IV treatment or a shot?
No, that is you get in a big needle in the arm, and the blood comes out, filtrates your plasma, takes out the gunk, recirculates your blood back in here, and then up here there's an IV with the new proteins and albumin dripping after that.
So,
3 liters. We get 3 liters worth of toxic stuff that is coming out. Sometimes it comes out black. Like with Morgellons patients, it comes out black.
no way. I believe it. I mean, there are a lot of sick people walking around that have no idea what how to treat this first. And I think you make such a great point of treating it through the blood. And it makes sense. And I'm hoping that because you also see all extremes of Lyme disease and tick-borne infection, that you are able to turn the boat around for people that are in extreme distress, hospital bound, about to die, and you have had great results. And I just want to know, for the average person that comes to see you and makes this commitment to you to go through the four stages, what's the time frame for them? What, how many trips would they need to make? What does that package look like?
The majority of cases I see once because I am of the idea that we want to do this right. Lyme has this kind of window of time where if you hit it right, you can get over it. And if you pass that window, you can keep hitting it and you're not going to get that much ahead of it. And so I believe in the level of intensity, and there has to be a balance with also the patient's homeostasis. You can't hit a patient too much that you are affecting the patient's homeostasis. And I have to identify what that patient's homeostasis is. Because some patients come to see me and their homeostasis is up here and the infection is up here. I hit that infection hard and the homeostasis drops a little. Perfect. That's the perfect scenario. But I have patients who come in a different circumstance and their homeostasis is down here. The infection is up here. I hit this intense Their homeostasis drops so much that it's poor quality of life for them. I can't live with that. So I have to be cautious of that. And because of that, in some cases, I have to be very gentle and increase their homeostasis to the point where we can now treat the infection, or increase their homeostasis and do plasmapheresis and red blood exchange to reduce the pathogen load before treating it. Now that makes sense.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. A perfect balance, individualized for each person. So, would somebody, for instance, come there and stay a couple a week, or how many, what's the average?
The window, this the as they say, the sweet spot is from 3 to 4 weeks in simple cases. In more moderate cases, it's from 4 to 6 weeks. In difficult cases, it's from 6 to 8 weeks. I never treat anybody more than 10 weeks ever, because if I do, the homeostasis is so low that anything I do here is going to have no more effects, because I'm affecting the cellular function and is vital for basic function of that patient. And this is sometimes that something that we neglect. And so we want to throw the kitchen sink at them, right? Or the patient comes to me and says, "Oh, doc, throw the kitchen sink at me." Sure, if you're strong, I will throw it in there. But if you're not in there in that capacity, we have to start differently. And so I never treat anybody more than 10 weeks, because I had this one case which begged me to do it, and I was still learning at that time. And I saw that pattern where that's just that we were doing everything right, but just the lab reports and the vitals just kept not looking better. They just kept looking worse, worse, worse. And I'm like, this is not gonna work. Because how can I, and that's where I realized, how can I keep hitting something without hitting you? I can't take the human out of the equation. So we are affecting the human too. So we have to consider that. So simple cases, 4 weeks, intermediate, 6 weeks, other cases, 8 weeks. I have had patients see me more than once. Yes, of course. I say like 5% of my patients have seen me more than once. And then I have very few cases that I have had to see more than 3 times. It's less than 1% for sure. Keep in mind that when I see them and I treat them here, after that, I send them home with a protocol that will be used for 3 months, in some cases 6 months, until their immune systems are right, because otherwise they will relapse quickly. And that is if they're not also relapsing on their own account by getting exposed to mold, by doing a dental surgery, other types of surgery, getting pregnant, having an emotional breakdown or a breakup, or losing some family members. Those things will get you relapse, even if you're in remission.
I have a quick question, last question I'll ask you. It may not be in your expertise to comment on this, but are you seeing babies born with Lyme disease because their mothers passed it down to them?
Yeah, in utero, transmission of Lyme is something very well documented in medical literature. I see it in my medical practice. Some of these cases will develop also some genetic changes, like they will have poor methylation. They sometimes will have issues with their heart formation. They sometimes will also have issues with their neurological development, and some of them will not achieve their milestones. So it's very varied depending on the case. And I always tell the mothers I treat, don't treat your children unless they have symptoms, because I also see some that the mother is sick and they had the patient that the, they had the child when they were sick, and they're afraid of what's going to happen to them. But sometimes it's opening Pandora's box. So it's best to, even if they're testing positive, I would still be cautious and say, let's maybe wait until they develop even one symptom.
That's great advice. Dr. Morales, I have enjoyed this so much. In closing, can you tell everybody how to get in touch with you, where you're located, and any final words?
I'm located in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. I'm just gonna brag about it because I love this town. I'm not originally from here. I moved here because it was the safest place in Mexico. It still is the safest town. It's actually safer than most towns in the US, believe it or not. Safe is ranked safest town in Latin America or something like that. And we have cruise ships coming, flights from everywhere, Canada, Europe, US. It's a very live town. And it's in the ocean. It's right in the Pacific, so it would be in the middle between Cancun and Tijuana, if you know a little bit of geography of Mexico. It's a 2 hour and a half flight from California, and a 4 hour flight from Florida, something like that. It is we are a we're a well we're a little larger now, but we still consider ourselves a small clinic. Because we're very focused on each case. But we're a small clinic. We're located in the medical district, which is maybe 3, 4 blocks from the ocean. And we have a shopping mall in front of our office. The hospital is entrance is next to our entrance. On the other side, we have the imaging center and all medical offices in that street. And that's where you guys would find us. Closing remarks, nothing. I love what I do, and I'm very passionate for my patients, especially those that have been neglected. And so, if there's anything that we can do to help, don't hesitate to let us know. And whatever you saw in this video is exactly what you're going to receive in person.
Thank you so much for your time. It's Lyme Disease Mexico. We're thrilled and honored that you enlight I learned so much just in these few minutes of talking with you, and I'm excited for everybody to reach out to you and to get to know you and to maybe come and visit you and get treatment.
Well, Ali, thank you so much. I love this conversation and the questions as well. It's always good to answer some question that really refreshes the mind. And it was lovely speaking with you. I hope your audience likes this video, and looking forward to future collaborations of any kind.
Thank you. See you soon.